The world's central bankers want to give banks more access to cash.
But will it be enough to ease the credit crunch?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, the last day of November, November 30th.
All right, coming up, what does the recent market turmoil mean when it comes to jobs?
Global banks get some bad grades.
And here's a great holiday story for you, Jeremy. What are people stealing from the stores these days?
Well, we'll find out, I guess, in a few minutes on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses and the computer files they depend on. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
The world's biggest central banks, including the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, have announced a coordinated plan to ease the credit crunch and make it easier for banks to get their hands on U.S. dollars when they need it.
Marketplace's Heidi Moore is with us now to talk about that story. Morning, Heidi.
Hi, Steve.
What concerns are these central banks responding to?
Well, you put it best. It's a credit crunch. We are staring another credit crunch straight in the face. And the source of it, of course, is European banks. They're loaded down with the debt of troubled European countries like Italy and Greece, and they are dealing in euros. And the problem is the dollar is the currency that greases the world's financial system. So those banks need to borrow in dollars, but to do that, they have to trade euros. And nobody wants to buy euros, right? Because then you have all those Italy and Greece problems behind them. We don't even know if the euro is going to survive.
Mm.
So the central banks are stepping in and saying, we're going to make it easier for you to borrow dollars. And here's how we're going to do it. The Fed is going to make it easy for the European Central Bank to get dollars. They're going to trade Fed dollars for European Central Bank euros. And then the European Central Bank is going to lend those dollars to European banks and companies at much lower interest rates than they would find in the rest of the market.
Liquidity injections, to be sure. So what are we talking about when we throw out the word liquidity?
I know it's one of those dense Wall Street words, but it actually has a really simple meaning. It means finding a buyer for every seller, right? So
yeah.
Think about it like a machine that's greased with oil, like your car, right? So liquidity means that those gears can move. You have supply and demand, buyers and sellers trading. And when liquidity dries up, just like when the oil dries up in your car, those gears don't move as quickly, right? Like they start to gum up and the
crunch,
gears don't work.
Yeah.
Right, and you get a crunch.
Marketplace's Heidi Moore. Heidi, thanks.
Thank you.
Some analysis now and Fusion Analytics' Josh Brown, who joins us as he does every Wednesday from New York. Hey, Josh.
Good morning.
So explain what these central banks are up to and why this was deemed necessary.
What the central banks basically did was they saw the governments were not acting and that rather than sit there and watch these acute liquidity problems become worse and worse, they've done something that allows money to be cheaper for the ECB, which in turn allows money to be cheaper and more accessible, I think is the key, to Eurozone banks, sovereigns, et cetera.
There was some sort of a credit crunch that was starting to show up in some of the indicators that economists look at.
Italians simply could not sell debt for a reasonable rate. Banks stopped doing business with each other because nobody trusted each other, and it was spiraling out of control. So you saw the central bankers from around the world come together and say, we are not going to have this whole thing go down just because of a lack of liquidity.
And what's the risk, Josh?
The risk is always the same. There are people that will say this is going to lead to inflation. We heard that in 2008, of course, inflation has been non-existent since. It's always possible. The other risk is moral hazard. I think that's a lesser risk in this case. Better to deal with that in the future. Moral hazard is where people say, well, look, we can take on as much risk as we want because there's always going to be someone to come in and save us.
Right.
Of course, that's a risk. But I think at this point, the bigger risk is to just sit back and watch this thing become unsolvable, unfixable, which it looks like the global central bankers are not willing to do. So that's a good thing.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also today, European finance ministers meeting in Brussels failed to come up with a plan to force countries to live within their means.
That says Germany and France continue to push the idea of policing national budgets around the eurozone. Our Economy 4.0 series looks at how the economy can better serve more people.
And Marketplace's David Brancaccio is with us. He wonders what these financial enforcers might look like. Hey, David.
Good morning.
What is it? A squad of budget police? Is that what it is?
In a way, yeah. A SWAT team with green eye shades who can boss countries around, like maybe the International Monetary Fund does in the developing world. They can say, hey, Italy, hey, Spain, you want the financial security courtesy of the European Union? Then you need to have these budget cops looking over your shoulders so that you keep a lid on government spending.
Now, this is a move, David, towards centralizing Europe's budget process, right? I mean, how would this solve Europe's problems?
So if these budget police could make sure that all of Europe is prudent, careful, not too much in debt, then maybe powerful German politicians might change their minds about how Europe's central bank acts in an emergency. Maybe they'd finally be willing to let the ECB print tons of money, which could once and for all calm down bond investors.
Would it work?
Oh, maybe, but here's the problem. So these budget police whip everybody into line with austerity. What happens then to economic growth, you have to ask yourself. Mark Blythe, a political scientist at Brown University, puts it this way.
If you insist on slashing the only part of the economy which is still spending, it doesn't work.
Well, then there's the question, David, about whether Europe actually has the gumption to give up sovereignty like this. I mean, in effect, some of that sovereignty would go to powerful Germany, right?
You got that right. They have this summit coming up in about a week and a half, the EU does, and we'll see how far they're willing to go. But listen to Matthias Matisse, who teaches at both Johns Hopkins and American University. He says setting up a budget police like this is really at the heart of all politics.
If you take the first class in politics in college, they'll tell you politics is about who gets what, when, and how. And this is what it's about. So, I mean, I just don't quite see how 17 countries can agree on what means good spending or good taxation.
Of course, a good financial crisis, Steve, can change old thinking. Who was it, the Polish foreign minister this week saying, quote, I fear German power less than I'm beginning to fear German inactivity. Can you believe it?
Yeah, really. Marketplace's David Brancaccio with our Economy 4.0. David, thanks.
You bet.
Well, Steve, the news this morning that the central banks are launching this big coordinated effort to give the banks more access to cash has at least probably something to do with what happened yesterday. Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency, downgraded not one, not two, but dozens of financial institutions all around the world. Here in the U.S., that list includes Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs.
And the downgrades, of course, come as S&P overhauls its rating system. I noticed when I first came into work today that European shares were down like a percent, right?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. We got this word about the coordinated effort by the central banks, and then now stocks are up, at least as of this recording, stocks are up at least 300 points here in the States for the Dow. We got news today as well, and this could have something to do with how much stocks are lifted today. We got news from payroll services firm ADP that private employers added 206,000 jobs in November. That beat by a long shot what analysts had predicted.
Also today, we got another early look at the employment picture from job placement company Challenger Gray & Christmas, that the number of planned layoffs dropped about a percent in November, and that number is down 13% from a year ago. The firm's CEO, John Challenger, is with us from Chicago with more. John, good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So what do these numbers tell you?
Well, they do suggest that the pace of downsizing continues to be relatively light. In fact, we came off the 28-month high back in September now with two relatively low job cut numbers in October and November.
And how do your numbers tell you that the European debt crisis is impacting our job market here in the U.S.?
Well, so far, the area where that hits hardest would seem to be the financial sector. It was the second heaviest area cutting jobs this month, with about 1,600 plus cuts, but so far for the year, 56,000.
So the financial sector is the second heaviest, the first heaviest being what, government jobs?
Government continues to lead the way, 18,000 plus cuts this month. 13,000 of those came out of the military. The government certainly is in a place right now where it continues to every month cut into the gains being made by the private sector.
And the government job cuts that we're seeing have been for the last many months at the state and local level. But as you write in this morning's report, the federal government is where you're going to be looking for cuts going forward.
Looks like the heaviest government cuts, you know, are moving to the federal level. Not only the military, but every other agency in Washington is now more at risk. They'll all be targets for the cost cutting. The post office alone could see workforce reductions affecting 200,000 employees, according to some sources.
Finally, I want to get your thoughts on one of the big debates going on in Washington. It's about tax cuts, obviously, both for middle Americans and middle income Americans, and also for top earners, and whether those tax cuts will lead to job growth if they're continued. Have you seen evidence that that is the case?
Well, certainly they may free up spending power on the part of consumers, although we had a very strong start to the retail season. Let's hope that means more jobs this season for retailers. But long term, it's really more about the deficit. Even the super committee's triggers only make a small dent in the problem that we have going forward.
John Challenger, CEO of Challenger Gray and Christmas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, of course, on Friday, Jeremy and John, we're going to get the big November employment report from the Labor Department. And we also got word today that worker productivity rose at the fastest clip in more than a year.
Yeah, the number of people who have signed contracts to buy a home also jumped in October. The National Association of Realtors says pending home sales rose to the highest level in a year.
Yeah, so some good economic news out today. Coming up, Napster says bye-bye for good.
And San Francisco wanted McDonald's to say bye-bye to its toys, but the fast food chain found a way around the new law. That's later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business. Carbonite Business is an online automatic backup solution designed specifically for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically and continually backs up computer files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other computer problem, files can easily be recovered. To learn more about Carbonite Business and to receive a free trial, visit carbonite.com and use the code Marketplace.
In Washington today, there will be a vote on whether to speed up the process of unionizing businesses. Now, the vote at the National Labor Relations Board is so controversial that a Republican member has even threatened to resign so the board won't be able to vote on that measure. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The National Labor Relations Board may seem obscure to you, but it's public enemy number one for the Chamber of Commerce. You notice that when you walk into the chamber's ornate lobby near the White House. I was there recently, early, for an interview. I looked around for something to read. I found a chamber publication headlined, National Labor Relations Board, Small Agency Poses Big Threat. Later, the chamber's labor expert, Michael Eastman, told me the board is doing too much too fast.
I think this is the most active period we've seen with the most number of controversial decisions in a short time.
Consider the issue of speeding up votes on unionizing. The chamber says employers need more time to persuade workers not to join unions. But the NLRB vote could set aside disputes over which workers can vote in union elections, eliminating delays. Eastman says this is the most activist board in 20 years.
that's silly.
That's Wilma Liebman, a Democrat and former chair of the NLRB. She compares the board to a comatose patient.
The patient woke up in the hospital bed and, you know, started to, you know, wiggle its toes. What's happened is the board has come to life.
Cornell labor economist Harry Katz says the board needed to snap out of its coma because today's workplace has changed since the labor law the NLRB enforces was passed. Now rank-and-file employees do more sophisticated work. So Katz says sometimes employers say they're managers and can't vote in union elections.
You know, the law was designed in the 1930s when we had a more typical sharp separation between the production worker on the shop floor and the manager.
Now the question becomes whether bringing the law up to date is activism or keeping up with the times. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
In the UK, government workers are staging today what they say is their biggest strike in three decades. Unions claim around 2 million public employees have walked off the job, and they're protesting government plans to cut pay and pensions. The government says it has to cut the country's deficit. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The strike has hit thousands of schools, hospitals, law courts and government offices across the UK. More than half the schools have closed. 60,000 non-urgent medical operations, hospital appointments and tests have been postponed. But the impact of the action has been less than feared. Flights in and out of London's two main airports have not been disrupted. And James Knightley of ING Bank says the economic harm is likely to be minimal.
It's more of an inconvenience, I would argue, rather than a major damage for the economy, because most of this economic loss from today should be made back again over the next couple of days or weeks.
Unions called the strike in protest over government plans to make public employees pay more and work longer for their pensions. The government claims it must cut its debt in order to avoid the fate of Eurozone governments, now facing the danger of default. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, Napster, Jeremy, is going the way of 8 tracks and cassettes. Remember 8 tracks and cassettes?
You love bringing up 8 tracks.
I do. Well,
you love 8 tracks.
I remember them fondly. The music file sharing service was bought by Rhapsody, we told you about months ago. And by tomorrow, it's completely going to be merged into it. It's been more than a decade since an unknown college freshman rocked the music business with that idea. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more from Silicon Valley.
Sean Fanning created Napster in 1999. It allowed college kids and quite a few grown-ups to instantly share music online. Max Dawson's a media professor at Northwestern University. He says Napster set a standard that streaming music businesses are still trying to match.
The sort of ease of use, the instantaneous access, that kind of celestial jukebox ideal.
Dawson says Napster was ahead of its time. It created a peer-to-peer network that foreshadowed social media today.
Mark Zuckerberg was still in Pampers, and Friendster hadn't even debuted yet.
But the major record labels saw Napster as a tool for pirates. The industry sued and forced Napster to abandon its original business model. The brand name lived on, but Napster never really recovered. And neither did the music business. Downloads didn't stop. Eventually, Apple convinced the big labels to start selling songs online for 99 cents. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, with record holiday shopping so far this year, Steve, there is also expected to be a lot of shoplifting, and Adweek has a list of some of the most shoplifted items. You ready for this?
Okay.
So Chanel No. 5 perfume is on there.
Eau de Toilette.
Exactly. And so is Axe body spray. So I guess thieves like to smell good when they're stealing stuff.
You want to smell good.
They also apparently like the new hot toy Let's Rock Elmo, which I didn't even know existed. I feel totally out of
that's
the
your
loop.
Kid after you stole it.
Yeah,
come on.
You know, I can see that. I can see that happening.
Man.
But the most stolen item is stolen from the grocery store, Steve.
Oh, yeah?
Steak.
Filet mignon.
Choice cuts of meat. That's
nice.
The number
maybe a
one.
Maybe ribeye, huh? Tenderloin?
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds good right now.
This week, coaches at some of America's best college football programs are prepping their teams for conference championship games, but other teams saw their seasons end and their football programs looking for new coaches.
Well, with scandals going on at Penn State and Syracuse, front and center, Jeremy, schools are doing even more to find just the right person for the job, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
It starts with how new coaches are hired.
A lot of this is done informally and perhaps not very transparently.
Raymond Sauer is a sports economist at Clemson University. He says many athletic departments find their coaches through other coaches.
We'll see more thorough background checks
on everyone, trainers, assistants, and head coaches. Many universities may beef up the staff responsible for oversight of athletic programs.
Now schools have to be on alert in an even higher level.
Kenneth Shropshire is the director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative.
Just because someone has been somewhere for a long time does not mean they should escape scrutiny in issues off the field.
Because the cost of a scandal far outweighs the cost of compliance. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
So, of course, Steve, we are all taught from a young age that cheating is wrong.
Wrong.
In the school, in the workplace, creativity is considered a good thing. It's rewarded, but According to a new study, creative people are also more likely to cheat.
In today's Midday Extra, we ask, can creativity cause harm in the workplace? And Francesca Gino worked on the study. She's a professor at Harvard Business School, and she's with us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, tell us what you found in your study.
We conducted a series of studies where we found a very interesting relationship between creativity and dishonesty. And the relationship works in two ways. It's a relationship that works both for creative personality. So it turns out that people who are more creative, who have a more creative personality, are more likely to cheat, and they're more likely to be, we use the word, morally flexible. So they're more able to come up with a lot of reasons for why their unethical behavior is actually morally okay.
Morally flexible.
Morally flexible.
I don't know what to say about that.
Exactly.
Wow.
But what's interesting is that we don't only see the relationship between the creative personality and moral flexibility and dishonesty, but we see the same relationship when we put people in a state where we are asking them to be creative. So we call that they have a creative mindset.
How do you measure, Professor, creativity? I mean, it seems like it's kind of subjective, right? I mean, people would have different ideas of it.
Right. It turns out that there is quite a bit of literature on that. And in our studies, in terms of looking at creativity as a personality measure, we looked at both behaviors that suggest that people are creative. So, for example, there are measures that look at the frequency of 80 different behaviors, such as painted an original picture or wrote an original computer program or doing something creative in the sphere of school or work-related activities. So that captures behaviors that suggest that the person is creative, but then there are also measures looking at creative personality in terms of whether or not people believe they're insightful, inventive, original, unconventional. And finally, we use the measures that it's known as a creative cognitive style, and that's a self-reported measure looking at whether people feel they have a lot of creative ideas or they prefer tasks that make them think innovatively or in original manners.
And do you have any sense of why these creative people are so likely to cheat?
Yeah, so the why is actually in the moral flexibility. So it's true that creativity...
Thank you for using that term
again. They want to get ahead, right?
Right. That moral flexibility gives them the ability to come up with a lot of reasons to justify their behaviors and to come up with reasons for why their behavior in the end is okay.
Do they think they're smarter than other people, that they can sort of outwit them?
What is interesting is that there is a lot of talk about how intelligence might be a component of creativity. What we do in some of our studies is actually controlling for intelligence. And so what is really interesting is that, and again, there are standard measures to capture intelligence and IQ, but what we see in our study is that even when controlling for intelligence, we find a strong relationship between creativity and dishonesty, suggesting that it's really this ability to come up with reasons to justify behavior that leads them to cross ethical boundaries.
And Professor Gino, what do you hope that people learn from this? Why did you do this study in the first place?
So we were inspired by a lot of the talks in news articles that have used the label evil genius, for example, to refer to Bernie Madoff, who over many years made more than $20 billion disappear in a creative Ponzi scheme. So there was a lot of language around the descriptions of this action as creatively unethical. And so we were inspired by those examples. What we hope to do is really raising a red flag. So we are now in a very global society where in order to be ahead, people need to be competitive. And usually when we think about a global and competitive society, we say, oh, people need to be creative and innovative. And in fact, organizations try to foster that. But I think that our research suggests that there might be some side effects to consider when we are asking employees or individuals more generally to be creative.
So the next time, Professor, the next time I cheat, then I won't be called, I won't call myself a cheater. I'll just say I'm morally
creative.
Flexible.
Morally flexible.
I'm morally flexible. Yeah, I didn't cheat. I was just morally flexible. Come on.
There is something to say about the fact that when we see people cross ethical boundaries in creative manners, we just perceive that as more morally acceptable. I have a beautiful story from a friend who was telling me, thinking very hard about whether or not to punish her child because he had transgressed rules in a very creative manner. And so I think we just understand acts and transgressions that seem creative a little bit differently.
Professor Francesca Gino at Harvard Business School, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, this morning, Jeremy, Francesca, San Francisco's new law banning free toys with unhealthy food goes into effect tomorrow. The target, of course, was McDonald's Happy Meals, right? They didn't want this enticement of, you know, kids coming in to eat all this unhealthy stuff that had a lot of fat and calories and stuff like that because they're giving you a toy. Well, Mickey D's has found a way around this. Kids and parents will be able to order their Happy Meals and pay an extra 10 cents for the toy. Mm. So the new law will actually bring in even more money for McDonald's, and the company says all those extra dimes will actually benefit its charity, the Ronald McDonald Charities. And the kids, of course, will continue to get their fix of fat and calories and sugar and Chinese plastic. That's good. Everybody loves Chinese plastic, right?
Sometimes you need some Chinese plastic toys
to help you get through
that. Yeah, exactly. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. Enjoy your Wednesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.